Hello and welcome to You Don't Know Lit. I'm Nick Argyris.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, guys. Is this where we're supposed to be?
You're coming in too early. You're coming in way too early.
Who is this talking?
I had at least a whole nother sentence to get to.
Wait, you called me.
You guys.
It's the new year, folks, which means it's a good time to torture Nick.
Gentlemen, today I'm looking for a book. A fun book. I'd like to have some fun, and I'd like your recommendations to help me. Are you guys? Are two English teachers? You're really throwing the POV.
No, you've got it. You're doing a good job.
Now, who am I talking to?
Well, my name is. Is this my time? Do I go?
I think so.
Do I go? My name is Joseph Harvey Holeshoe. I'm a high school English teacher, Nick. And Nick, if you're looking for a fun book to read, I brought one. It's not a good book. It's a fun book. It is called Ready Player One. Kind of big, massive hit. They made a movie out of it, directed by Steven Spielberg. Pretty big deal. Ready Player One by Ernest Cline.
That sounds fun. Thank you, Joe.
It's fun. Ready Player Fun.
Damn it.
How about this? 20 fun reads for 2020 fun.
Ooh, that's pretty
good. Instead of 2021 is the joke.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's very fun.
Thank you, guys. I really appreciate your positive reinforcement. Hello, I'm Dr. Ian Beavertooth DeYoung. I'm a high school English teacher. And today, Nick, if you're looking for a fun read, I recommend Lewis Sacker's Newbery Medal winning young adult novel, Holes, which is a listener recommendation coming to us from Chris. Thank you, Chris, for this recommendation today.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you, Chris. This should be a very fun episode.
May your earlobes turn into assholes and shit on your shoulders.
Hey, the plot doesn't fucking matter at all. This is what I think it's about.
If you look closely enough, every author was at some point a racist.
Audiobooks don't count, right?
All art is quite useless.
Who told you that?
Fun fact, that is how Joe laughs.
What's a fun read? Like, lots of explosions? I know what a fun movie is. Guns, jumping. There's usually jumping. But what's a fun book?
More or less the same, actually. Very similar.
I think it's...
Let's break
kind
it down into excruciating detail.
Yeah, that's what the Litheads come here for, is excruciatingly explaining what makes things funny or fun or, you know.
Detailed analysis.
I've been told that one of the strengths of our podcast is how just clearly and just brutally we explain jokes away.
Everything and anything. All right. I think that's all the fun banter we have time for today. Should we move on to the 30-second plot points?
Nick is this week's warden.
The Bring warden out your of fun. Nick's here to embrace fun, to regulate fun, and to mete it out, to dole it out. Not so much liberally as you know,
stringently,
sparingly.
Sparingly.
I imagine Nick having a big old like cauldron of fun, and we file past him with our metal trays, and he slops a scant spoonful in our tray, and we might say, "Please, sir, can I have some more?
Please, Nick, can I have some more?"
Nick, can I have some more?
Yeah, but instead of a ladle, I like meticulously measure the fun and give it out in the perfect dosage.
Right.
Do you have a nozzle?
A nozzle.
Like a
milliliter.
Like a regulated nozzle that you squeeze the squeezer and it squirts out a metric quarter cup of fun.
No. So there's nothing more fun than a time limit. So... Joe, do you want to take 30 seconds and explain to me what your fun book is all about?
Absolutely, Nick. Ready Player One, written by Ernest Cline in 2012 and 274 pages long, is the worst book I've ever loved. It is a young adult adventure novel set in dystopian 2040, a world where trailers are stacked in skyscrapers and where global warming has brought on widespread energy crises, social unrest, and economic stagnation. But hey, if you need an escape, just log into your Oasis, a virtual universe where the real action of the book takes place. That's what our hero does. He's an unlikely hero relying on his knowledge of 1980s pop culture to win the day. Okay, that's good.
2012
written in 2012. Movie was 2018, just a couple of years ago. The movie was, and yeah, it's fun.
I just started learning about how like directors get to like pull, like they have the rights to basically adaptations. And and like how basically everybody calls dibs and like the dynamics between like that and like how scripts float around and like so like a script will get written and then like directors will get to call dibs. It's really fascinating. I'd like to learn more about it.
Well, and I would imagine there's a hierarchy too. Like, so this is directed by Steven Spielberg, and you have to imagine that Steven Spielberg gets first dibs. Like, everybody wants Spielberg to make their movie. On every script.
I don't think,
like,
guys, I don't think there's like a list in Hollywood, and you like move up the seniority list. And
I think there is. I think that's actually probably pretty much exactly how it works.
I think it's called the A-list, isn't it?
Yep, that's right, Joe.
That's it. That's where it comes from.
Ian.
Hey.
Have fun with this next 30 seconds, please.
Okay. When young Stanley Yelnats is sent to a prison camp for a crime he didn't commit, he's made to dig 5-foot deep holes in the desert to build character, or so the warden tells him. But she has a much more nefarious purpose, and before long, Stanley's embroiled in a treasure hunt generations in the making. Life-saving onions, venomous lizards, and a baseball player named Sweet Feet are just some of the key plot elements that make Holes, which is published in 1998 and is 223 pages, the funnest of fun reads.
So, Ian, a treasure hunt.
Yep.
Generations in the making.
Generations.
I think you and I maybe read the same book this week. My book also revolves around a treasure hunt that is generations in the making.
That's very true. You should we should rebrand this episode, or we should have like an alternate branding, which is treasure hunts, because that's a really good call.
Fun treasure hunts.
Ian, is Donkey Kong in your book?
Good question.
No.
Okay, then Joe, why don't you go first? Because that sounds. I think Donkey Kong is in your book.
Donkey Kong. Oh boy. Yeah.
Is this just going to be kind of like the Wild West, or are there any rules to help us sort of add chaos to this order, or vice versa?
Yes. Rules. We do have those. We have a couple show rules. Rule number one, only unavoidable spoilers. Rule number two, omit needless words, Joe. And rule number three, winning isn't everything. It's the only thing. So are you guys prepared to win today? Do you feel like you're going to win? Who has the more fun book?
Mine's more fun.
Think so?
Pretty fun.
Joe,
yes.
Kick us off. Tell us about your fun book.
All right, Nick. First, a little bit of an overview of the plot. We...
a 5-minute overview of the plot.
Nick... have you seen this movie? Have you seen Ready Player One, Nick? Have you read this book?
I have. I think I'm the only one. Okay, this is what I know. I have seen the movie.
Okay.
I'm the only one in all of my friends who liked it.
Yeah.
And I think it accomplished exactly what it's supposed to accomplish, which is to be viewed in a movie theater in 3D and to have fun.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. When we came up with the genre for this week.
But to be clear, it's a terrible movie.
Yeah. Hey, it's not a great book either. But Nick, it is a fun, fun book. So just a quick overview for the litheads who haven't seen this. There is a dystopia. It is the year 2045. And basically the world gone to hell. Right. That famous fun setting dystopia. The world's in terrible shape in 2045. There is... however, this program, this virtual reality program called the Oasis, which basically everybody on the planet uses to escape from horrible, horrible reality. The owner of the Oasis, the founder of the Oasis, is like the wealthiest dude on the planet. He dies, and in his will, he leaves a treasure hunt where you have to find a series of Easter eggs and things like that throughout the Oasis. Yeah, that's pretty much it. That's pretty much it. The main character is this guy named Wade. Most of the time, he goes by his screen name, his avatar name, Parzival. He is a teenage boy, 13, 14 years old, and he is obsessed with 1980s pop culture, which is kind of weird because it's set in 2045. So it's kind of like you or I being obsessed with like the pop culture of post World War II.
Steampunk. When was that popular? I guess my big question is, in the movie, you have all sorts of wacky characters coming out from the 1980s.
Yes.
How does the book do that in a way that's actually fun?
Okay. So,
or does it not?
I'm just going to get right into my three things here. So,
Joe's famous three things.
Instead of answering that question,
his famous three spices and herbs.
When you read this book, the star of this book, like there's a plot in this book. There are characters in this book. They're fine, right? Like the plot is fine. It is a page turner. It moves the plot forward. The characters in this book are fine. They are vehicles for the plot. The star of this book is the references to 1980s pop culture. Like that is honest to God, the main appeal of this book. And they are like incredibly fun. Like it is a lot of fun seeing things pop up that you remember, but they are also incredibly obnoxious after a while. And Nick, when you say you're the only one out of all of your friends to have liked this movie, that's a really like hating this movie.
Enjoyed the movie.
Yeah. Enjoyed hating this movie. Hating this book is kind of like an internet merit badge of the 21st century, right? Like, like you aren't a real nerd unless you hate Ready Player One.
Gotcha. Do you think people that actually like the 80s pop culture, do you think are more or less likely to hate this movie?
Well, okay. This is a question that I have because Nick, you were born in, I was actually, when I was doing my prep, I was trying to remember how old
my birthday?
You, well, how old you are.
87.
You're born in 1987.
Nick, could you please also share your social security number and your driver's license number?
Home address would be fantastic.
I'll post them later.
Great.
When you read this book, Nick, or when you watch this movie, it is full of pop culture references. The pop culture references almost entirely come from between 1981 and 1989. They are 80s pop culture references. Oof. But here's the thing.
I going to miss them?
Yeah, you were born in 1987.
How good was my memory at the age of two? Not very, Joe.
So I have this strange experience when I read this book. I was born a couple years before you. I was born in 1985. I also don't remember 80s pop culture except as a reference that you're supposed to be able to get, if that makes sense. So like when we talk about, Raiders of the Lost Ark, like I didn't see that new, but I've seen it. When we talk about, you know, like the Return of the Jedi, I didn't see it new, but I've seen it. Right? Are you with me on this?
I am with you. I'm not sure where we're going, but I'm with you in this vehicle of fun.
So it's kind of this jarring experience to read because it relies so intensely on its nostalgia for 80s pop culture. But it's a young adult novel. And like, of course, the young adults reading this, they don't know 80s pop culture except as this pop culture reference that they're maybe supposed to know. I'm not explaining this.
So you think just to clarify, this book is more for like your dad, like somebody in their 50s or 60s who really enjoyed the 80s.
let me offer a counterpoint. Shows like Stranger Things, which rely on that sort of 80s nostalgia, it seems like they have two separate fan bases. You've got the people who are alive for it and say, oh, yes, I remember when I did my hair exactly like that. And you've got the people who maybe weren't alive for it, but have some degree of sense. I know this is roughly what it was like. And oh, look, it's doing the thing that I somewhat recognize.
Is this like your big brother's book that you found? And you're like, ah, yes, this is cool.
Yeah, that's maybe not a terrible comparison. And I think the Stranger Things comparison is really good too. Like we do have this nostalgia, like culturally, we have nostalgia for things that we didn't experience. I think we all have this nostalgia for like the 60s, for example. Like we think of the 60s and we think of hippie culture and it's like, oh, wow, how cool was that? Even though we were never there. I feel like the 80s is sort of a thing like that for the current generation because I have students in my classroom. You know, this is a young adult novel. This is a novel that's on most teachers' English shelves right now, most English teachers' bookshelves. And it's a student, it's a book that my freshmen in high school pick up and they burn through. I mean, reluctant readers burn through this. And I always wonder how much of it they really catch, like how much of it they really get, how much of it they really, I don't know, have access to.
I think the 80s were the funnest decade, correct, Joe? Now you are the expert here. So
it scores very high in fun, the 80s.
In fun. Mm-hmm. It's getting an 8.9 in fun.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think that is?
I don't know. A lot of drugs and no wars. No, there's wars.
There were tons of wars. There was a sense of impending doom, too.
I went through my checklist of things that you need to have fun. Mm-hmm. Drugs and no wars.
Yep. Cold war.
Probably just the drugs then. More drugs.
Maybe I think it was like a lack of irony. Everything was colorful, or so we're told by such hit films as Wonderful Woman 1984. And like, I think maybe there's a sense that color is fine.
Oh, well, it's not the first decade on color. I've seen 1970s, and it's like a little more patinaed, but that also was colorful.
Yeah, but the colors in the 70s were like avocado puce.
And everything was avocado.
Misery yellow.
I do think there's, like in the 80s, I think there's this sense of shamelessness. I'm not sure.
This is a shameless book.
Like maybe maybe a lack of self. Oh, this book is shameless. Absolutely.
Joe, give us the taste of some of this shameless callback. Is it like how does it work?
Okay.
Nick, you might have to quote us.
Yeah. Nick, are you familiar with the literary term an allusion, A-L-L-U-S-I-O-N, allusion.
I have heard of it, yes.
Okay.
You may have heard this on the episode with Silverlock, where we read a book that was completely made up of allusions.
Perfect. Mm-hmm. So when an allusion is done well, it rewards a reader, rewards a viewer, rewards a listener, whatever it is, for some sort of cultural or some sort of like deeper knowledge that they have. And usually when an allusion is done, it's like a nod or a wink or a nudge, just like, hey, you know this thing. Like you recognize this thing. And the example I always think of is, and this is really like a structural allusion, but Martin Luther King has a famous letter that he wrote from Birmingham Jail. It's called Letter from Birmingham Jail. And he wrote it to like the greater diocese in the area, basically talking about, yes, I'm in jail, but I am here for like the morally right reasons. And this is why the diocese should support the civil rights movement. In that letter, there is, and boy, this is fun, guys. In that letter,
there is
a structural allusion to the letters that Paul wrote when he was in jail. Paul the Apostle, this is, right?
Oh, Jesus. Now, yeah, let's, the most fun book, the Bible.
That's right. But like the fact that he has like this allusion, if you want to call it that, the fact that like King writing from jail mirrors Paul writing from jail. And Paul is, of course, spreading the word of Christ and King is spreading the word of civil rights or equality, whatever you want to call it. Like the people in the diocese, his audience would be aware of this. Like they would see that. And there's additional moral weight. There's additional value because of that allusion. Like it is value added.
So we talked about this. Go ahead.
Just real quick, famous 80s rock band Guns N' Roses had an album, Use Your Illusion. Any connection there? No.
I don't know much about Guns N' Roses.
Yes. I would say that there is a connection. They, much like Beyonce and the rest of Destiny's Child, Guns N' Roses are time travelers, and they knew this was going to happen. Yes. They actually kind of time traveled forward and influenced Ernest Cline to write this novel. And then they went back to their time and they wrote this album as kind of a call forward to What was to come?
Oh, call forward. Fantastic.
So Ian, what are your thoughts on Joe's book not sounding very fun?
Okay, so full disclosure, I have read this book, and I would say
thank you for disclosing that.
Yeah, I conflict of interest or whatever. Yeah. I would say it's fun, but the danger of this kind of book, and this is the danger that I ran into with Silverlock.
Too much fun.
Well, kind of. Like, and Joe, I'd be interested in your thoughts on this. When you read a book that is clearly doing a lot of allusive work and you don't get all the allusions, or even maybe you don't get very many of them, that can be kind of alienating. Like, you read it.
Can you feel left out, Joe?
You understand that this book is like for someone who knows some things. And as you read, you're like, I am someone, but I do not know these things. And that's a bit of a bummer. So, Joe, your thoughts.
It can be a bit of a bummer. And when I read this book, so I think there's a couple takes on this. Number one, when an allusion is done well, it's a wink and a nod, right? This is like a club that Ernest Cline hits you over the head with. Like, it is just like, wham! Remember Star Wars? Wham! Remember Donkey Kong? Wham! Remember Back to the Future? Like, that's what it feels like reading this. And there's a lot of layers of like the references that he uses here. And a lot of them are as obvious as the ones that I just said. And then other ones are like weird 80s video games that weren't for me, that I didn't play. And do I feel alienated? I don't know. I get a bunch of them. Yeah, like I understand a bunch of the references.
Now, do you Google them meticulously, being like, oh, what was that?
Oh, that would be exhausting.
What was that? So I don't get it.
So Nick, I was.
Does this have an appendix for fun?
Oh,
it's like goes. If you enjoyed this fun
like
reference,
footnotes.
Yeah, footnotes.
When you read Shakespeare nowadays, Shakespeare did a lot of in jokes, but most modern readers don't know them unless you've done a PhD on that stuff, and even then, sometimes you don't. So you have to have footnotes that say, "Oh, this is a reference to a famous woman in London who had a huge bed." I kind of feel like maybe in 30 years, if Ready Player One is still an international global bestseller, we might need the annotated Ready Player One.
Is everybody from the 80s in this? Is Michael Jackson in this?
Oh, okay.
So is Michael Jordan?
Fantastic question. I was looking for an exhaustive list of like the allusions in this book, the references in this book. And I found one on, of all places, Schmoop, which is this place that high school students go
to. Sorry, what?
Yeah, Schmoop. Schmoop. It's this place.
Tell us what Schmoop is.
This week, You Don't Know Lit is brought to you by Schmoop.
Schmoop. Schmoop.com.
Now, are these the books you keep in your bathroom? Schmoop books?
Oh. Nick, do you remember... Spark Notes? Nick, did you do Spark Notes?
Oh, yes, I do.
Okay.
Yes.
Spark Notes
I went
Schmoop.
To school.
Yeah, Schmoop is Spark Notes. However, it's like more in bullet point format. And Schmoop has a list of all the references that it could gather from Ready Player One. Nick, the references in this book took up 15 pages of just
pages.
Like line reference. Like it is dense. It is thick with references. And Ian, you talk about, well, what if you don't get these references? Like what if these aren't for you? Do you lose something?
Is this for cool kids only?
Is this for cool kids only? I think there's two pieces of this. Number one, kids read it now. And they get them, or at least they enjoyed the book without getting them. So I think like, well, maybe they're missing it. Maybe they're missing something, but I think it's fine. Like it's still kind of this madcap adventure story without understanding these references. But number two, I found this video by this girl named Jenny Nicholson, who I'd never heard of before this. And she had made a video called Ready Player One for Girls. And in it, she would read pages of Ernest Cline's Ready Player One, but all she would do is substitute the references from what they were to things that a girl of the similar age might be aware of, right? Like might be, it might be more familiar with her. So it's kind of an interesting take on it. And watching just the videos, you know, 5 minutes or something like that. Just watching a little sampling of it, you can see how instantly alienating it is as somebody who doesn't understand or have like an emotional connection to these references. Like as soon as she's not talking about, you know, Back to the Future and Batman, Barbies. But is instead talking about My Little Pony, like I just don't care anymore. Like instantly I don't care anymore. And I feel like that has to be what this book is for a lot of people.
Is this a boy book?
It's absolutely a boy book. I think Ernest Cline would say it's a nerd book, but it's, I think, a nerd that, boy book.
I think as we know, nerds tend to skew boy.
One, it seems like based on that observation, Joe, it seems like maybe what Cline is doing is saying nerd culture and boy 1980 culture are the same. So therefore, if you are a nerd who is a woman, and you don't get these, well, maybe you're not a nerd. Maybe women can't be nerds. Like that's a kind of a concerning conflation to say boy culture is nerd culture, and if you don't like it, we'll get out.
Joe brings yet another sexist book to the podcast. that's what I'm picking up on. Joe,
yeah,
we've told you time and time again.
Please stop
bringing your sexist books.
I want to hear why, Joe. So, Joe, you said this is the worst book you've ever enjoyed. So you talked a lot about enjoyment of it, but like, how does that mesh with worstness? What do you mean by worst? Like, is it poorly written? Is it like what? How does that fit together?
Yep. So great question. It is poorly written. Right. And I think like the poorly writtenness comes from a variety of dimensions. Like, I think, for example, like the characters in this book are like they're flat. Like the characters in this book don't particularly grow. They don't particularly change. It's kind of a diverse cast of characters, but it is very like skin deep diversity. It's like, they have an Asian one and they have a white one and they have a girl, right? Like that's kind of where it is. There is a female character in this book who is literally a trophy at the end of this book. Like he, well, no spoilers.
And you're saying this is fun for you?
No, this is part of the worst.
This is part of the worst part. Nick.
Oh, this is the worst stuff. Gotcha.
This is the worst stuff. But it also has this propulsive page turniness, like the references that are just omnipresent in this do kind of keep you engaged and keep you hooked, like even if they are a little bit low hanging fruit, even if they are a little bit again like skin deep or surface level. But ultimately I think this book has a handful of redeeming qualities, which is why I bring it this week.
Just so I'm tracking here, you're basically saying like, yeah, characters and writing pass.
Yeah.
But Michael Jackson fights Donkey Kong on page 3 and it's a page turner. You just got to see who wins that fight.
So Nick, like you talked about liking this movie or enjoying this movie. What was your word for it?
Enjoying.
Yeah, consuming. But you talked about enjoying this movie because it's a popcorn flick. This,
yeah, oh yeah.
This book.
Don't watch this at home or spend money on it.
This
unless
book,
the screen's 8 times bigger than your body.
This book is a popcorn book, right? Like it is enjoyable for the exact same reason that the movie based on it is enjoyable. It is like this mindless, fun page turner. I've spent a lot of time like talking about why this book isn't like that great of a book, but hating on this book for being bad is like leaving a 1-star review for a McDonald's hamburger. Like it's not,
you're wasting your time. Yeah,
that's exactly it. It's not fine dining, but that's kind of the point. Like it is this fun Fair romp enough. Through nostalgia mixed with dystopia, like propelled by an Easter egg hunt. It is just a boy. Can I say fun one more time? It is just a fun book to read, Nick, and that's why
I think we're done. I think we're done here. Sounds fun, Joe. Thank you. Wait, who's the author? We didn't talk about the author at all. Is this guy fun?
He's
any secrets, Joe? Any hidden?
Does he know that Orson Scott Card?
He has a kind of surprisingly scant Wikipedia page. His name's Ernest Cline. He is a writer. He has some slam poetry that he did before he was a published novelist.
And I bet that was great.
And boy, when you talk about, yeah, Ian, when you talk about, hey, this guy's being kind of exclusive when he's saying like, look, nerd culture is boy culture. The name of the slam poem is Nerd Porn A Tour. And the very first two lines of it are, I noticed there don't seem to be many porno movies that are made for guys like me. And he proceeds to write a lengthy.
Sounds like a cool guy.
Yeah. It's kind of this lengthy thing about, like, it's almost like porn for nice guys.
No.
Where he's like, look, ladies, I would respect you in the porn that I made.
Everything you just said is the worst.
Yeah. So I don't have much about this guy. He seems like kind of like an uber nice guy. I don't know. He's not great. I won't read any more of this poem right now, but hey, maybe for the quote at the end of the show, litheads. If.
Okay. Well, have we ever had a good person write a book? Ever?
Totally.
Yeah.
There was
yeah.
that one. Right. That one guy.
Hey, guys. So Dune is coming out in like 8 months. You guys want to talk about that? How many dozens of Dune books are there?
Do you know what? Do you know what Frank Herbert or whatever his name is said after the first one came out and it was so successful? Mm-hmm. He said, well, I'm Dune something, right? I'll just keep going.
That's pretty
good.
Hey,
that's funny. Do you guys...
I thought it was pretty funny. One of the cool things about Dune, Nick, isn't just that there are eight of them and that Frank Herbert was a fan of a good pun, but it is that, like, in a lot of ways, it really defined a lot of the science fiction fantasy that came after it. Like, it was a genre definer. Like, it
would you
set
call
the stage
it a genre
for what
definer
was for to come. I would and will be next week calling it a genre definer. Yes,
incredible. Ian, do you have any genre definers?
I do. So there's a book. It's kind of a mind trip. It's called Neuromancer, and by author William Gibson. It's kind of got the whole cyberpunk thing going. I will read this and I will talk about it, but be warned, it's a hard book to talk about, so I might do a terrible job. This is a listener recommendation from Turi. So
okay, so we can blame her. We can blame her on.
Blame her, Turi.
Turi is a him, and yes, we will absolutely blame him for.
Sorry, Turi.
I'm excited to get into this book. It's a pretty cool, pretty cool story.
And what genre is it defining?
Cyberpunk.
Cyberpunk.
And what genre does yours define? Sand.
Sand, yes, sandlet.
Sandworm lit. It does predate Star Wars, which famously has sandworms.
Right. Also Tremors.
Yes.
You've seen,
a lot
yes.
of sandworms. A
lot
That's
of sandworms.
Weird.
Dune started them all. Started the sandworm. We should bring the sandworm craze of the 70s and 80s. Started with Dune.
Hey, Ian, do you have a book called Holes you'd like to tell me about?
I do. But before we do that, could I give you guys, like, nicknames?
Oh.
This is a big part of this book, is the nicknames. And the nicknames are usually based on something that happens in the person's life, or it's like a play on their name. So there's a character named X-Ray, which is Pig Latin for Rex, which is his name. There's a character named Armpit who gets stung by a scorpion and his armpit swells up. So I thought I'd give you, I have nicknames picked out for you to call you by over the course of this, my presentation. But if you'd like to choose your nickname, you can try. So,
well, I think this is a trap. I don't think you can actually give yourself a nickname. I think every 9-year old boy tries it and every 9-year old boy fails.
That's true.
I want you to call me Blade.
Because I'm a blade.
Fuck that. Call me Blade, Ian.
I'm not gonna call you Blade. That's too cool. These nicknames are not cool necessarily.
Joe,
in a callback to just a wonderful episode about agriculture, I think I'm gonna call you Puss Plug.
Oh, good God, that's I hope that sticks.
And Nick, yours is a little bit more obscure, but it's a story that sticks in my mind about you. I'm going to call you Mandolin.
Okay, I don't get it.
Because one time in the before times, you told me about getting pulled over by a policeman who was very curious about the kitchen implement, the mandolin, in the seat of your car. And mostly when I think of you, I don't like think of your face. I think of you having a mandolin instead of your face. So,
And good. I like it because it sounds like Mandalorian. Which
it does
is
sound
obviously
like Mandalorian.
A very cool show.
Right.
Yeah. And is better than
it does
Baby
sound
Yoda.
Like that. But just to be clear, your name is not Mandalorian. Your name is Mandolin, which
the
is
Mandolin. The much worse Star
it's like
Wars
a
story.
Cheap knockoff.
Now on the Peacock Network.
Or I'm imagining like fake merch that's manufactured overseas.
It's Gordon Ramsay's new Star Wars travel spin-off show.
The Mandolin.
Oh, I'd love that.
Yeah.
Okay, let me tell you guys Mandolin and Puss Plug. Let me tell you about this book. So
let's just call him PP for short.
I hate this. For the record.
So I'm going to tell you about the plot, which is kind of the plot's pretty important, and then I'll tell you about some reasons why you should like it, if that's okay. Why this is a fun read and so forth. Okay, so this book, the main character is a boy named Stanley Yelnats, and his last name Yelnats is his first name backwards. Stanley Yelnats, it's a palindrome, and that doesn't really matter to the plot. It's just. It's interesting. So
is there a lot of name play in this book? Is that where some of the fun starts?
Yes, my goodness, there is. Names are kind of like key to the way this book works. So, and there's a lot of irony based on names and a lot of kind of, development. So anyway, he is convicted. Stanley is convicted of stealing the shoes of a star baseball player who is, as I mentioned in my 30-second plot, Clyde Sweetfeet Livingston, another fun name. He doesn't have sweet feet. He has stinky feet, but he gave his shoes up for auction for charity, and Stanley is convicted of stealing them, but he didn't steal them. That's kind of inciting incident. So he's sent to this labor camp, Camp Green Lake, which he quickly discovers
is lovely.
It doesn't sound lovely, but it's not. Well, it this does. Is another name thing. There is no lake. It is not green. It's a desert. It's a remote. And all the kids at this correctional institution, they have to dig holes 5 foot wide, 5 foot deep. And they're told it's to build their character. But over time, various things
social
happen.
Distancing.
Get in your hole.
Why don't we do that?
Right. All have a hole.
Because you don't need a hole that big to bury your head in. Anyway, keep going.
Along the way, he various things happen, and he realizes that the warden of the camp is not, in fact, trying to build their character, but instead using them as basically forced labor for a treasure hunt. There is treasure buried somewhere out there, and she is this ruthless in pursuit of it, and she wants the treasure. So he has to deal with other early teen boys, and that's a whole thing. And he also gets personally tangled up in this treasure hunt and eventually goes on the run. And I'm not going to get into the last half of the book because the plot just goes crazy. I really don't want to spoil it, but there are fermented peaches, there is a miraculous pig, and there is a decades old bad luck curse that all kind of factor into the way it ends. So
That sounds pretty good. I like the idea of a bad luck curse. It feels very campy to me. Like Camp Green Lake, it feels like a camp thing. Do they get drunk on the fermented peaches? Like, is that why they're fermented? Is this peach wine?
This is the thing. When I first read this book a while ago, I was sure that they got drunk on them. Mm-hmm. Reading this time, I was really curious. Like, does this book depict 13, 14-year-old boys getting drunk peaches?
Right.
Mm-hmm. But it doesn't. They just like
that's
it makes
not very
them,
fun.
That would be
it
more
makes them
fun.
Feel good, but then they also one of the jars of fermented peaches is spoiled, and it gives the boy a bad case of food poisoning.
I think they just got drunk. It makes them feel good, and then they were throwing up afterwards. That Ian, I have a question.
Sounds like you're not reading between the lines, Ian.
Have you ever been drunk, Ian? That's pretty much how it goes.
That is how it feels.
Being drunk doesn't usually involve a week-long bout of diarrhea and vomiting.
Well, Maybe you're not getting
maybe
drunk
for you.
Oh man, you could read so many poop books. So
really, really work through the back of the toilet.
Good God.
You guys are fucking gross.
I think there's been a little too much poop
over there
here
and poop books over there.
Mandolin.
Call me Mando.
No, I'm not going to call you Mando. You have not earned that.
Damn it.
Is a mandolin what you slice onions with? Like, am I thinking like the right thing? It's almost like a guillotine on its side.
That's exactly how I would describe it, yes.
As a guillotine on its side.
A tiny onion slicing guillotine.
The French did invent it.
Speaking of onions, if you're a fan of onions, this book is big on onions.
Okay, good. Because that was my next question. So thank you. Yep.
Onions end up saving people's lives like 3 separate times in this book.
Really? That feels like an unlikely amount of times for onions to save somebody's life.
I mean, I think one is kind of an unlikely amount.
Right. But you would suspend your disbelief for one. And maybe the second time you're like, oh, well, I guess it's kind of a callback and it was foreshadowed. But the third time.
Yeah. At the third time, you're like, is there an onion god that's watching over me or something? Like what? 2 times even.
A panacea fixes everything.
Exactly. A panacea.
Well, okay, so Joe, you mentioned suspending disbelief, and this is one of the reasons that I think this is a fun book and a good book, and I like this book. Mm. So, are you guys familiar with the subgenre of magical realism?
I've heard of it. Joe, have you ever heard of it?
Yeah, I've heard of it, but I never really know what it is. Is it kind of like when a talking coyote shows up in a book, but you're just like, yeah, there's just a talking coyote in this book. Like, is that what we're talking about here?
Yeah, it's like,
you know what I think of magic, the alchemist is what I always think.
Yeah.
Of.
Yeah, that kind of thing. Magic supernatural events are presented as just kind of normal every day. In this book, there are curses and there's fate and there's destiny. And the story is not like, yes, and then he cast magic missile from his fingertips. It's just like, yeah, this stuff exists, maybe, possibly, kind of. And it's not like a focus of it. So this book, okay, back to the book. This book does magical realism. It's mostly told from the perspective of our main character, Stanley, but it's got these other plot lines. So there's a story of how Stanley's great-great-grandfather offended an Egyptian fortune teller and brought the aforementioned bad luck curse on Stanley's family. There's also the story of Kissin' Kate Barlow, who is a school teacher turned outlaw, and cool. She's the one who has the treasure. She's the best. She's one of my favorite parts of this book because she's got a kind of a tragic story, and then she gets revenge, and she has 20 years of outlaw revenge, and it's amazing. So there's kind of this.
Sounds like the characters are much better than Joe's.
Oh, goodness. I'm not going to say better than Joe's. I will say really, really good. So these characters are just so well crafted. He does a lot in a little over 200 pages. So he's very economical with his words. But you really get a sense of the main characters, sort of the way they interact with the world, their values, their priorities. To by the end, you kind of are friends with them. Even the characters who don't talk very much, there's a character named Zero, which is a pretty cool nickname. And he doesn't talk much, but we get a really, really good sense of his complicated psychology. So I mentioned earlier kind of navigating early teen boyhood social dynamics. And that's like, there is a serious amount of just really good psychological drama here. But there's also adventure and peaches, so.
Our loyal lithead Chris wrote this about Holes. Holes is a childhood favorite of mine that manages to weave 3 seemingly separate stories into one. It's a fun read that you can breeze through in a few hours and is one of the books that I attribute to my love of reading, too. It's also one of the most faithful book-to-movie adaptations I can think of and has a character's name, Mr. Sir. Need I say more? My question for you is, Ian, need you say more? Tell us about Mr. Sir.
Just read Chris's. That's a really it's a really good synopsis. Mr. Sir is.
What are the 3 stories?
Well, I just told you. I literally just mentioned them to you. There's the story of the great grandfather who brings the bad luck curse. There's the story of Kissin' Kate Barlow, and there's the story of our hero Stanley Yelnats, who has to dig holes and goes on the run. thing you should know is these three stories take place at three kind of points in time. So the first one takes place in like the mid 1800s, and the second one takes place around the turn of the century, like 1910 or so. And then Stanley's story is 1990s. So they all kind of like things from the far, far past trickle down into the present. Mm. I wonder, so Joe is talking about like the delight of spotting kind of allusions and references.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Specifically outside of like front to larger culture. This book actually does that too, but it makes references to things that happen earlier in the story or to elements that you know from these other interrelated stories that the characters.
I think that's just called good storytelling.
I think so. I mean, yeah, I think it's connected.
Foreshadowing. Foreshadowing. Reward a yeah. careful reader? Do you have to be a careful reader to spot these, or is it pretty obvious?
Can even the dummies get it?
Mm-hmm. I would say it's a really delicate balance because the careful reader will get it the first time. There's like a little mention, like, and you're like, oh, his name. That means he's a descendant of that character. But if you don't get it at first, you'll eventually get it because the story concludes with this really awesome kind of positive triumphant
on your second
moment.
Or third reread, you'll get it.
Well, and I will say we've talked about this. This is why they call it lit. You can reread it over and over.
Right. That's why they call it lit.
My goodness. Chris, thank you for recommending this. I had forgotten this existed and I had forgotten how much I loved it. I opened this up and I was so like engrossed, even though I knew it was going to happen, that I was carrying it around with me on Christmas Day reading it while I was preparing food because I literally was unputdownable. You know when a book kind of like beats you over the head with something and just hammers it and not anything we've heard about recently, but a book that maybe just has a motif and it just keeps coming back to it over and over and over. Imagine, if you will, a book like that. This book, Holes, doesn't do that. It shifts these perspectives at the exact right moment. And it reminds me of like a TV show juggling multiple storylines where just when you're like about to be like, okay, I get this. I'm on the same wavelength. I've got the rhythm. It shifts to a different storyline. So you're always kind of on your toes and it keeps this mystery going throughout the whole book. It's just got this momentum, which is really, really impressive. It sounds like kind of simple, but it's really, really complex. And this is one of the ways I judge a book's quality. Does it carry me along? Am I caught up by it? And I think the way this book is written, just so kind of economical with its words and well-crafted. Yeah, I'm caught up by it. I'm carried along.
I feel like nicknames are really crucial to like, I'm sure there's a name for this genre, but like I immediately, when I hear this, I think about the Goonies.
Mouth.
And like, yeah.
Chunk.
And like yeah, nicknames I think are like real the clutch there as well. Yeah. Any connection to fun and nicknames, Ian? Analyze this, please.
I think it's one of the ways that we kind of show that we're close to someone and we know them. And this is kind of how Mandolin and Puss Plug, it's how I show
you agree,
that
pee-pee?
I know you and I'm familiar with your darkest secrets about Puss and Mandolins.
Mando.
So it's a way that you kind of like, you when you have a group that's nicknamed each other, you know they're tight. It's kind of a quick little writer's shorthand, I think. Because you guys know, and Joe mentioned you can't give yourself a nickname. You know, like, nicknames have to happen naturally. And if they don't happen naturally, it's dumb. It's stupid. It doesn't work.
Doesn't make any sense.
Right. So I think yeah, there's maybe not an explicit call out to the Goonies, but this broader sense of young people nickname each other. They're close. Let me be clear, though. These boys are not here for fun. Like, this is not a summer camp. Stanley thinks it's a summer
camp. No, it's essentially child labor. Yeah.
Right.
It's forced labor. It's pretty grim. And I've said a lot of stuff about, like, peaches and diarrhea and, like, fun stuff like that. But the story includes some pretty serious violence. There's a man who's killed for, he's black and he's romantically involved with a white woman, and so they kill him for that.
Wow, that's pretty dark.
It is.
That's pretty dark. So like on one hand, fun romp through Green Lake summer camp. On the other hand, critique on the privatized prison system and interracial relationships.
This is a funny thing. So
spell F-U-N, really, Joe.
I don't really know how he does this. It's got this really, this whole story has this sort of sarcastic, wry, comic voice, which is sort of just distanced enough that it can point out how ludicrous the injustices that are happening are. But it also deals with these really big issues like racism in the prison system, illiteracy, homelessness. They're dealt with in serious ways, but they're not patronizing. And I don't think Holes should work as well as it does both ways. Like, it is both fun and enjoyable, and also, what's secret learning, really? That's what it is.
Secret
learning. It gets you, it teaches you stuff. A lot of young adult lit tries to deal with serious issues, but not much young adult lit actually does it well. Like, there's a lot of...
Or does it in an enjoyable way. Yeah.
Hey, Joe, what's Ian's nickname?
I've been sitting here brainstorming nicknames for him, but I...
How about Brainstorm?
No.
No, it's too cool. All right.
That's a pretty cool nickname. I feel like nicknames are never the ones that you want, right? Like, it's never never cool. Like, I had an
Not
uncle
unless
that,
you're on the basketball team. They get all the good ones.
Is that true? Yeah, like Stretch and Hands.
Dunker.
Dunker.
Shooter.
Dunkin' Donuts.
Pistol Pete Maravich.
Michael Jordan. Mm-hmm. Did you guys know that was actually his nickname?
Michael J. Fox.
Yep. That's another Mike name that starts with Michael.
Mike Tyson. Mike Jackson?
Oh, no. We're back.
I think Ian's nickname should be Michael Jackson.
Oh, no. Oh, I don't like it.
While I deliberate, do you guys want to hawk our show?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You bet. All right. Hey, Lidheads, here in 2021, we think it would be 2020 fun for you to hit us up with more recommendations. Thank you. I've been working on that all show long. If I seemed a bit checked out this episode, that's why. You can head on over to our social media at You Don't Know Lit on Twitter and Instagram. We also have a Facebook page, or you can go to the website, youdontknowlitpodcast.com, submit a book recommendation, or yell at us for just destroying your trust in an author, whatever you want to do. You can leave a review at the iTunes store, 5 stars if you please, or you can tell a friend, or you can paint our logo on a mountainside.
Oh, that would be great.
Joe, how else could people do this?
The number one thing I would emphasize is you might have an author that you love right now, but you might suspect that they're a secret racist or maybe a secret Nazi. Here at You Don't Know Lit, we get to the bottom of these things. We do extensive author research. Yes, there is no Nazi left unturned. That's one of our mini mottos here.
Into Google, into Wikipedia. Mm-hmm. We check all the main sources.
All the main sources, the Reddit comments. We go to the comments, guys. So, You Don't Know Lit, if you want an author that you suspect might be a creep, please submit his book and we will find out for you.
Weird.
Yep, it's true.
Joe, you win, but only because I really want to hear more of Ernest Cline's erotic fan fiction.
Yeah, okay. So I'm only going to read pieces of this because it is just like...
Explicit?
Well, kind of, actually. Yeah, in places, I would say yes. So Ernest Cline, when he was a slam poet, by the way, this is noted as one of his most famous slam poems, he wrote a poem called... I forgot it already. I keep forgetting the title. It is Nerd Porn Auteur, and the first two lines are...
Check it out, everybody.
I've noticed there don't seem to be many porno movies that are made for guys like me. So he starts out by describing, in some detail, the type of girls that are in pornos. And then he says, but I don't want to watch girls like that. And he says, but I don't want to watch this misogynist, he-man, woman-hater porn. I want porno movies that are made with guys like me in mind. Guys that know that the sexiest thing in the world is a woman who's smarter than you are. You can have the whole cheerleading squad. I want the girl in the tweed skirt and the horn-rimmed glasses. Betty Finabowski, the valedictorian. Which is why I'm going to start writing and directing geek porno. I shall be the quintessential nerd porn auteur, and the woman in my porno movies will be the kind that drive nerds like me mad with desire. I'm talking about the girl that used to fuck up the grading curve, the girls in the Latin Club and National Honor Society, chicks with weird clothes, braces, four eyes, and 4.0 GPAs, brainy, articulate bookworms with Mensa cards in their purses and chips on their shoulders. My porn starlets will come in all shapes and sizes. My porn starlets will be too busy working on their PhD to go to the gym. In my kind of porno movies, girls wouldn't even have to get naked. They just take guys down to the rec room and beat them repeatedly at chess, and then talk to them for hours about Heisenberg's uncertainty principle or the underlying social metaphors in the Aliens movies. Buy stock in some hand cream companies because there's about to be a shortage, and I'm not just talking about straight porn. Oh no. There should be fuck films for my nerd brethren of all sexual orientations, gay nerd porn flicks with dungeons and drag queens. This idea is a gold mine. I'm going to make millions because this country is full of database programmers and electronics engineers, and they aren't getting the loving they so desperately need. And you can help. If you're an intelligent woman and is interested in breaking into the adult film industry, and you can tell me the name of Luke Skywalker's home planet, then you are hired. It doesn't matter if you think you're overweight or unattractive. It doesn't matter if you don't think you're beautiful. You are beautiful. And I will make you a star.